Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here, back here on the Mark Steiner Show. We're about to look at a decision that deeply affects the Fourth Amendment that just happened in the Supreme Court that took place the other day, a 5-3 vote in Utah versus Streiff. I'm not sure it's Streiff or Strife, but I'll say Streiff. We're going to analyze what that was. We're watching a house got a tip in Salt Lake City, and we're looking at what they thought was drug activity. An officer stopped this man, Edward Streiff, on his way to a convenience store, and then found out he had a minor parking ticket that he had not paid. Used that as an excuse to frisk him, stop him, get his ID, and then found some methamphetamine on him. This went to court, so they upheld that conviction after the Utah Supreme Court overturned it. There was a scathing dissent by Justice Sonia Sotomayor Ginsburg and Ellen Kagan. So we're joined right now by Adam Liptak, who is the Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. Adam, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Good to have you back in the studio, Doug.
Nice to be here. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Doug.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can join us by email at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So, Adam, when I read this, obviously, as many people did, I was just stunned by the decision and the interpretation of the Fourth Amendment. Talk a bit about your analysis of what happened here.
Well, the big picture is that this is a court that has been cutting back on the exclusionary rule for some time. That's the rule that you suppress evidence obtained by illegal police conduct. And here there was no question but that the stop of this guy was illegal. There was no good reason to stop him. There was no reasonable suspicion. But it's also true that he had an outstanding warrant. It was, as you say, for a minor offense, but nonetheless, it was a real warrant. And it's also true that he had drugs on him. So the court says there's not enough of a link between the initial stop and the fact of the arrest warrant, which is valid, and the fact of the drugs, which is true. And so it's a sort of conservative way of thinking about the world that we're not going to try to go after and deter police misconduct, which the stop was, by letting the criminal go free. And as you said, Mark, Justice Sotomayor really took this argument apart and said that in the modern world where 7 or 8 million Americans have warrants for them for generally quite minor things, this just gives police the ability to stop and search anyone they like without any fear of being called out for misconduct. And she said, and persuasively so, that this smells of a police state.
Doug Colbert.
Well, Mark, this is one of the most disturbing and deplorable decisions that the Supreme Court has ruled, certainly in the area of Fourth Amendment law, because fundamentally it changes everything that we thought had to occur before the police could stop. Before the police could detain someone and investigate and look up to see if you have any outstanding warrants or anything. Fourth Amendment protects our privacy, Mark. It protects our ability to come and go as we please. And frankly, most white folks expect that they're not going to be interfered with when they walk the streets or when they drive their car. But we've seen too much of the racial profiling that takes place. We've seen too much of police abusing that discretion. And so what's interesting in the Utah case is that it involves a white person who was leaving a home, leaving someone's house. The police so-called surveillance never saw when this individual went into the home. He could have been visiting his friends. He could have been there overnight. He could have been lots of things. So you have somebody walking out of a house down the street to do a little shopping or something, and that's where the officers stop him, detain him, run his name through the criminal records history, find a warrant. And once they find an open warrant, and the warrant is for not paying a fine, which is what many people have, when the court says that there's a staggering number of outstanding warrants, They said 7.8 million, and I think that number is quite low, Mark. I think it's actually it's considerably higher, but you have 8 million people who live every day in jeopardy that they'll be either stopped on the street, in their car, or at their home for failing to come to court, failing to pay a fine. And that's where you have to look at this decision, because it's not isolated, as Justice Thomas suggests. It is what Justice Sotomayor and Kagan and Ginsburg agree. This is a pattern and practice. This is something where there are many people. In our city, we have 40 to 45,000 warrants for failing to appear in court. Poor people, low-income people miss court either because they have transportation issues, they don't have money to get to court, they have jobs they want to keep, school that they want to attend, children, elderly people to care for. But because they don't have the private lawyer who can step up and explain, my client can't be here. So we have many people in our own city who are quite vulnerable to arrest on the warrant. And once, as Adam says, once you get arrested on the warrant, the police can do a full-blown search.
Because, Adam, I think the question of what suspicion means and how police define whether or not you're suspicious or something suspicious is going on gets to the heart of what might happen here. We're sitting in Baltimore where Freddie Gray was stopped because of another Supreme Court decision, the Wardlow decision, because Freddie Gray looked at a police officer, turned, and went the other way, and then they pursued, which was acceptable under Wardlow. So now you add this to it.
This in a way you could say is even worse, because here – everyone agrees. The police conceded, the prosecutors conceded, the state of Utah conceded that the stop had been illegal and unconstitutional. The stop was no good under the Fourth Amendment. Even so, the decision says, the fact that there's independently a warrant allowed the arrest and search. So this layers one problem on top of another. Now, I guess one way to think about it, and I know Doug has given this some thought, is that there's different pressure points here. There may well be many too many warrants out there. In general, though, you would think that we want people who have a warrant out for their arrest to be arrested. Right? I mean, it may be that that we're issuing too many warrants, but that's a problem with warrants, not with the Fourth Amendment. So there is a tension here, and five Supreme Court justices, including Justice Breyer, typically liberal, did see enough merit in this argument to think that the criminal justice system is better off by arresting and during the arrest searching people with outstanding warrants.
So before we jump into that, let me ask a quick question. So did Justice Breyer, who often votes with the three women justices,
yes,
did he write an opinion as well?
No, he voted silently with the majority, and he is more conservative than the women on criminal procedure issues, but not that much more conservative. And in the last two exclusionary rule cases, which this is one of, he was an alarmed dissenter that the Roberts Court was doing damage to this
Right,
decades-old principle. So what was going on here with Breyer is a little confusing.
I thought so, too. That's why I asked the question.
Yeah, and Adam's done a great deal of writing in bringing these issues to the public, and he's, frankly, one of the few that's giving attention to the pretrial justice system. But, Mark, one of the things that ought to frighten every person who's listening to your program or who reads about this case, the police no longer need reasonable suspicion to stop and detain and question. They no longer need an articulable basis for having made the initial stop. That was the fundamental pieces of Fourth Amendment law. Now all the officer need do, and this is where Justice Sotomayor in the second sentence of this opinion says, do not be soothed by the court's by the opinion's technical language. Because the way Justice Thomas writes this opinion is that you really don't get a sense of just how much damage has been done to people's rights of privacy. And when you talk about people, you always have to then go to who are the people most likely to be stopped on the street, not because they have any basis, no suspicion of a crime, but because the officer may now think you might have an outstanding warrant. You might be one of the 7.8 million people. I can stop you. I can question you. I can tell you to stay right where you are until I do a name check. And if you are one of those people, and there are so many people, Mark, who can't make it to court either because they don't have the money to pay the fine, they don't have anyone to step in for them. And so what happens is the police now have the vehicle to stop anyone on the street. And that's what makes it such a disingenuous decision, or one in which the majority of the justices are just out of touch with how systemic the practice is.
Well, the entire quote you're talking about here in that paragraph, in the opening paragraph, was, "Do not be soothed by the opinion's technical language." This comes out of an article I'm reading, I think, out of Huffington Post. "Do not be soothed by the opinion's technical language. The case allows the police to stop you on the street, demand your identification, and check it for outstanding traffic warrants, even if you're doing nothing wrong," is what she wrote in an opening paragraph in response to Utah v. Streif.
Right, doing nothing wrong. You see, what Justice Sotomayor is doing, and I think Adam, who reads, you know, so many more opinions than I'm able to do, but it's almost as though she's writing this to the public. I mean, she's using the word "you" in every sentence. This allows the police to stop you on the street, demand your identification, even if you are doing nothing wrong. I mean, she's really sending out the alarm here of just how this may impact on ordinary people's rights to come and go. And Adam made another important reference, because there are so many outstanding failure to appear warrants in our city, in our state, in our country. One of the things that we're calling for is the idea that the system ought to provide forgiveness, or to allow people safe passage,
right,
to come back to court, remove the warrant, and then deal with your cases. Because right now, people in our city, I'll just use Baltimore as the example, they live in fear every day that on a minor, relatively minor misdemeanor, nonviolent charge, which is what most of these warrants are for, that they will stand subject to arrest and spending 30 to 45 days in a local jail.
You know, we're now at this point, Adam, where we're talking about the mass incarceration in America. We have done so for the last 5 years or so or more. Really kind of intensely public conversation, I mean, even though many people are aware of it. I mean, this kind of opens the door to increasing that. Despite even some conservative legislatures around the country, others trying to cut back because of the cost. I mean, there are a lot of elements here, and I wonder if you...
And, you know, one we haven't really stressed adequately, but Sotomayor certainly does, and I agree with Doug that she can sometimes be a somewhat bureaucratic writer, not always a pleasure to read. This thing is an extraordinary document.
Yes.
It's one of her very finest pieces of writing, mm-hmm, and she stresses the very important point that this decision falls disproportionately and heavily on black and brown people. If you'll let me, let me read a couple.
Oh, please do. Please do. Please do.
I mean, she says she's talking from her own experience, and she does come from the project in the Bronx. She knows what she's talking about. She says, "For generations, black and brown parents have given their children the talk, instructing them never to run down the street, always keep your hands where they can be seen, do not even think of talking back to a stranger, all out of fear of how an officer with a gun will react to them." And she cites James Baldwin and Ta-Nehisi Coates. This is really the first Supreme Court opinion that resonates with the Black Lives Matter movement.
And she adds, Mark, in one other part, that the white defendant in this case, she says, shows that anyone's dignity can be violated in this manner. So she's really trying to call out a message to all of us to say, this is another decision like Wardlow that makes it very unsafe for people of color to be outside in the public arena, but it jeopardizes each and every one of our basic privacy rights. And so what leads me to say that this is the moment, this is the time when we have to be asking our judicial system, give people safe passage to come to the courthouse, remove the warrant, and then come back to court and deal with your misdemeanors.
I mean, I think that I'm going to open the phones here. And on the way there, I also, this is from the New York Times piece that I thought the closing paragraph.
In is that
the,
Adam's article?
No, I think it's the editorial that I was reading this morning. And I'll just read this, Adam, because I think it follows to what you were saying, and it's really important. Which she concluded with this language. And she says, by legitimizing the conduct that produces this double consciousness, this case tells everyone, white and black, guilty and innocent, that an officer can verify your legal status at any time. It says that your body is subject to invasion while courts excuse the violation of your rights. It implies that you are not a citizen of a democracy, but the subject of a carceral state, just waiting to be cataloged. We must not pretend that the countless people who are routinely targeted by police are quote-unquote isolated. They are canaries in the coal mine, whose deaths, civil and literal, warn us that no one can breathe in this atmosphere. They are the ones who recognize that unlawful police stops corrode all of our civil liberties and threaten all of our lives. Until their voices matter too, our justice system will continue to be anything but.
That was Justice Sotomayor.
That's what I just said.
Oh, okay.
Right. Who, that
I
was,
thought you said it was the New York Times.
No. It was
I'm sure it was that, quoting Sotomayor, but it's
right.
It's really an extraordinary passage.
Absolutely.
That says I conclude the article in Times with that quote.
Yeah. It's one of those decisions that I only hope that the media will give it the attention it deserves and that our justice system will respond in a good way.
I mean, in some ways, you know, I think about places like Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. I can name 24 cities and communities around this country, throughout Appalachia, black communities, Latino communities, Native American communities, where it almost not begs the argument that local communities have to change their own public safety policies to protect citizens from what can happen. I mean, we're in a very strange place, what this kind of ruling does to us.
Right, and this ruling is going to stand, so the reaction has to be local because this is a 5-3 ruling. Even if President Obama or President Clinton can put an additional nominee on the court, you still have only 5-4. So this constitutional rule will probably be in place for some time. But as Doug points out, that's not to say there aren't responses communities can have on the warrant side. Many too many warrants, many people.
Let me open the phones here and get our listeners in on this conversation of 410-319-8888 as we talk about this this really very critically important Supreme Court decision that just took place in Utah versus Streiff that really goes after the heart, many of us think, of the Fourth Amendment. We're here with Adam Liptak, you just heard, Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, Doug Colbert, who's professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, and you at 410-319-8888. You can also write to us by email, talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And let us go to Clarence on line one. You're on the air. Welcome.
Mr. Steiner, Professor Colbert, is it a fair thing to say that by this decision – a policy and practice such as stop and frisk is now unchallengeable by anybody, even a, you know, I remember New York was taking steps to get rid of the policy of stop and frisk, but now how does, you know, just to put a name on it, stop and frisk, does this legitimize any policy or practice by any local police department in the United States to stop and frisk at will? Thank you.
Thank you, Clarence.
Well, Clarence, I wouldn't go as far as what you said because every step in Fourth Amendment law requires consideration. So that what I'm saying is that the police, if a police officer wants to stop me on the street or you, the police officer can stop either of us and can ask questions and can say, I want to just stay right where you are. I want to run a check and see if you have any warrants. Once you find the warrant, that's when the officer would place me under arrest. Once I'm under arrest, the officer can do a full-blown search beyond the frisk. We're not talking here so much about the stop and frisk as we are about the stop, detention, investigation, looking for a warrant. The warrant is the touchstone that allows the police to make the arrest without reasonable suspicion, without probable cause in the beginning of the stopping, but rather to say that once you find the warrant, that's a cleansing mechanism. We know that the original stop was unlawful, but now that we found this warrant, whatever it might be for, we can now treat you as an arrestee, and now I can do a full search incident to arrest.
Did you want to add to that, Adam, before we open the phones again?
I think the answer to the question, does this endorse stop and frisk, even under Justice Thomas's reasoning, has to be no. This decision is about whether you must suppress evidence gained by an unlawful search. But Clarence Thomas says, first of all, he doesn't see any evidence that there's a flagrant dragnet kind of stop and frisk system going on in Utah. And he leaves the question open about whether you could suppress evidence gathered by that kind of dragnet systemic stop and frisk. And second, he says, there are other ways to deter police misconduct other than suppressing evidence. And he suggests that civil suits and internal discipline and other kinds of lawsuits remain possible. So I don't think this rules out the possibility, even after this decision, of somebody challenging, as they did in New York City, for instance, a regime of stopping.
Somebody over the phone said, what does that mean to you?
What it means is there's always been a very strong oppositional force to the exclusionary rule. And so for many years, the idea that you're deterring police misconduct by saying to the officer, you cannot use evidence that came from an illegal stop or search or seizure, that was the deterrent to say to officers, you got to get it right. Now what's happening, and Adam's right, that these proponents of who are against the exclusionary rule say, look, you can sue. You can recover money damages, but money damages, Mark, in my opinion, does not serve as an adequate deterrent against police misconduct, whether it's Fourth Amendment or any other constitutional violation.
410-319-8888. Robert, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thanks, Mark, for allowing me to speak on your program.
Appreciate you calling in.
I want to start by saying this. You know, I think that this new ruling handed down basically epitomizes our compromised legal system. I know that there have been rumors and connections regarding Clarence Thomas and even the late Scalia as far as having strong ties to lobbyist interests. So I question the motivation behind this because a lot of times without private, private jail industry, the lobbyists must be strong enough to basically affect law. You know, to, I guess, line their pockets. But what I also want to say, too, is that this latest ruling also kind of legitimizes profiling. For years, we've been talking about how profiling is immoral and discriminatory, and yet they turn around and they actually legitimize profiling. Because if a typical officer looks upon an average, everyday African-American male, or whether it be black or brown or wherever, you know, he has, I guess now the latitude to pretty much make a unilateral decision to stop this guy on simply his impression of what this person may be likely connected with, even though there is no legitimate reason to stop him to begin with. And by legitimizing the initial stop with his profile or discriminatory purview, so to speak, you're basically justifying humiliating people. You're also basically, what you're doing is you're also kind of reiterating the unspoken rule, which is basically that all blacks and all Latinos and all people of color are basically second-class citizens. You're basically reemphasizing the fact that irrespective of our symbolic gains through Obama, we are still secondary citizens. So this is basically the moneyed interest, the lobbyist interest, and twofold, lining their pockets at our expense and at the same time, humiliating us by reminding us that we are still in last place, that we should not be quote unquote too uppity because our rights, our humiliation, our dignity is always the low hanging fruit for these people, these so called neo fascists, neocons who are here to constantly undermine our dignity, to constantly undermine our humanity, to make sure that we know our place in this totem pole society. We live in a modern day caste system, whether we want to realize it or not. That's pretty much all I have to say.
Robert, well, you said a lot. Thank you, Robert, for the call. I think that, Adam, you know, one of the things that concerned me when I think about what Robert just said when I was looking at his decision is that I can see, you know, now that police anywhere in America, there could be young men hanging on a corner just talking, and it could be assumed as drug activity. So let me stop you and see who you are, see your ID, and see what warrants you have. It could be a man and woman who are on the street. Oh, that looks like a prostitute trying to get this customer. So let me stop these people and check, see who they are. I mean, it could be almost anything that we do. Especially if you are in a poor community or community of color, can look suspicious and be used as a reason to stop. I mean, I think that's what Justice Sotomayor was saying in her dissent, is how wide ranging the effects of this decision could be on policing in America.
I think both you and the caller make an excellent point. I think it would make profiling more attractive to police and easier to accomplish and very hard to combat. I guess I would stand up for Justice Thomas in one respect,
okay.
a minor point the caller made. You may well think the decision is wrong. I do think, though, that he didn't do it because of a lobbyist or because of some corrupt motive. I think it was a good faith, perhaps mistaken, but a good faith, earnest decision on his part and on the part of the four justices who joined him.
That's a good point, Adam. No, I think it's important to say that. I mean, I think that... That he has been a conservative justice, a conservative thinker, way before he came onto the court, way before he had any connections to any lobbyist or his wife did. I mean, that has been his political philosophy for a long time, Judge Thomas. I think.
The other point that the caller makes is the language of being second class citizen is the language embraced by Justice Sotomayor. She really understands. She really gets it, and I say that because Justice Sotomayor was a prosecuting attorney for many years, but she was someone who stood for the right values of a prosecuting attorney. She cared about people's rights. She also protected community from the relatively few who really harm community. The idea of profiling, I think in many ways this decision could justify a return to a policy of profiling, at least in those jurisdictions where the police commissioner or the powers that be or want to pursue that type of arrest policy, which of course has been discredited. The final thing in terms of money interest, I agree with Adam to the extent of what he has said, but I will point out that the money interests that benefit from this decision might well be the bail bond industry and the insurance companies, because once you're arrested again, and that's what's happening in these cases, and you're in jail, for many people, the only way out of jail is to pay a bail bondsman that very expensive 10% fee.
Which we'll be talking about another day in the coming week, because there'll be a conversation and debate we're going to have on the show next week, given what's happening in Baltimore around that issue. 410-319-8888. Let me go to Lavana on line 2. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Mark. Without detracting, you know, any sense from everything you're talking about during the segment, the way this leads to this atrocious targeting of black and brown people and profiling, I want to raise another dimension of it. When I heard that decision announced earlier this morning, I froze for a minute. I'm a 70-year-old white woman, and I have a history of civil disobedience and war resistance. And during the period of Bush's administration, I started looking seriously at needing to leave the country and get my whole family out, because when Patriot Act and Patriot Act 2 were passed, it began to lay out a scenario in which anyone could be picked up on the street and disappeared. And I know all those issues about the Patriot Act and all that kind of stuff has kind of gone underground because there are much more pressing immediate issues like this atrocious racism in our country. But I want to raise it because it isn't gone. And when we look at the possibility, I'm so glad another caller said neo-fascist. I was afraid to voice that. But when we have people in the highest candidacy running on neo-fascist terms, we have to remember that that never went anywhere. It was never reversed fully or prosecuted during Obama's administration. As much as he did a lot of good, that's still out there. And when the country turns again towards political prosecutions, it lays the groundwork for a totalitarian police state that anyone can be stopped, and they don't even have to be disappeared illegally or informally. They can be formally disappeared. I think it's an enormous looming problem.
I mean, there's no question that white people are certainly vulnerable to arrest or to being stopped and detained and investigated as people of color are. And so when you're a protester, you're certainly in that targeted group of being more likely to receive the attention of the police. I also, though, want to really emphasize that when this decision comes down, there is a response that I believe has to be made, and that is that the city of Baltimore, the state of Maryland, really has to provide a way for people who have warrants to come back to court safely, to get a lawyer, to contest the charge or have the charge dismissed. Warrant forgiveness is something that we really ought to be asking of our officials.
So one of the things you said in the close of one of your articles here in the New York Times, Adam, was an interesting quote, I think, from Justin Driver.
Yes.
Well, he said Justice Sotomayor's dissent was remarkable. He said the strongest indication that we have yet that the Black Lives Matter movement has made a difference at the Supreme Court, at least with one justice.
Well, I mean, one thing it shows us, this whole decision shows us, is that with the exception of Justice Sotomayor, and I should say, although there were three dissents, the part that we've been reading from was Justice Sotomayor writing by herself, joined by nobody else, and she's the one person who seems to have the background with whom this enormous social movement resonates. And the rest of them are, you know, old, elite, East Coast, rich justices who are far removed from the lives of the kind of people
who that's right.
I just want to add what I found interesting also is that the women, the sisters on the Supreme Court, they got it right. I mean, they didn't embrace, they didn't join Justice Sotomayor. She wrote her own part four. But the other dissenting opinions were very strong on Fourth Amendment protection. Why is it that all the guys lined up in favor of giving the police this enhanced power? I don't know, but it seems to me someone's going to be doing a gender analysis as well.
I'm sure that's
other
coming.
Types.
I'm sure that's coming.
Well, it's a little hard. I mean, it does look on the surface that this may have something to do with gender, but if you look at the votes of the justices across all kinds of cases, the three women are also the three most liberal members of the court on all kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to disentangle gender and ideology.
A question just before we have to run, Adam. What are the cases we need to be looking for in the next couple of weeks before the term ends?
Yeah, we've probably only got about three more days of decisions. We might be done as soon as Monday. The big cases yet to come are abortion, affirmative action, and immigration, all from Texas.
Right. I was talking to Sheila Knife the other day about the affirmative action case coming up. That they're all kind of very nervous about what's going to happen with this court and that ruling as well. What does that one entail? Can you tell us?
Affirmative action?
Yeah.
The University of Texas takes account of race in admitting students to the its flagship university in Austin. And that question of whether race-conscious admissions is constitutional is before the court. But I doubt that this shorthanded court, and on this one, Kagan is recused as well, so a seven-member court.
That's right.
I doubt that they're going to make a major move on affirmative action until they have a full nine.
And then the one around the abortion issue.
That has the potential to drive the number of abortion clinics in Texas from 40 to 10. The two parts of a Texas law make it hard for abortion clinics to stay open, and whether that satisfies the undue burden standard the court has announced in abortion cases is the question for the court. And there again, we'll see. But the early signs are that they're going to try to muddle through in some way without making a major decision.
And I think something we said very on the early on in the program that I think is really important to kind of explore in coming weeks here in Baltimore and across the country with our different sister stations and community groups is the local response, whether it's war on forgiveness or whether it has to do with redesigning what public safety means and who patrols the streets, the roles that different people play in this, how you minimize the effect of this on people's lives locally. I mean, I think that's where this kind of the twist of this will come back, and that's something we should really kind of look at very closely, and we will. Adam Liptak, let me first thank you. It's always great to have you on the air. We appreciate you taking your time with our listeners today.
Complete pleasure.
Supreme Court reporter of the New York Times will be linking to all of his writing on this case and other Supreme Court issues coming up in the next few days. And Doug Hallward, always good to have you in the studio, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Always good to have you. I'm sure we'll hear your voice tomorrow morning as we look at what the judge's decision will be in this latest round of cases involving Freddie Gray's death. So
it's a big day tomorrow in Baltimore and throughout the country.
So we'll talk. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for being here.
You're welcome.
On our way to a brief break, but stay with us. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Michael Denzel Smith about his new book. I'm going to take a short break. On our way to break, I'm going to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We'll be right back. Stay with us.